This is Audible.
ISIS Audiobooks presents an unabridged recording of While I Was Gone, written by Sue Miller. Read by Buffy Davis. The moral right of the author has been asserted. This performance is owned by ISIS Publishing Limited. Chapter 1. It's odd, I suppose, that when I think back over all that happened in that terrible time, one of my sharpest memories should be of some few moments the day before everything began. Seemingly unconnected to what followed, this memory is often one of the first things that comes to me when I call up those weeks, those months, the prelude, the long, beautiful, somber note I heard but chose to disregard. This is it. Silence between us. The only sounds, the noises of the boat, the squeal of the oarlocks when my husband pulled on the oars, the almost inaudible creak of the wooden seat with his slight motion, and then the glip and liquid swirl of the oars through the water, and the sound of the boat rushing forward. My husband's back was to me as I lay in the hard curve of the bow. He sat still a long time between each pull. The oars dripped, and then slowly stopped dripping. Everything quieted. Sometimes he picked up his fishing rod and reeled it in a bit, pulling it one way or another. Sometimes he recast, standing high above me in the boat, the light line whipping wider and wider, whistling faintly in its looping arc across the sky before he let it go. It was a day in mid-fall, well after the turning of the leaves. The weather was glorious. We always took one day off a week together, and if the weather was good, we often went fishing. Or my husband went fishing, and I went along, usually with a book to read. Even when the girls were small and it was harder to arrange, we managed at least part of the day alone together. In those early years, we sometimes made love in the boat when we were fishing, or in the woods. We had so little time and privacy at home. It was a Monday. The day off was always Monday, because Sunday was Daniel's busiest day at work, and Saturday was mine. Monday was our day of rest. And what I recollect of that Monday, that fine fall day, is that for some long moments in the boat, I was suddenly aware of my state in a way we aren't often. That is, I was abruptly and most intensely, sharply aware of all the aspects of life surrounding me, and yet of feeling neither part of it nor truly separated from it. Somehow impartial, unattached, an observer, yet sentient of it all. Deeply sentient, in fact, but to no apparent purpose. If I were trying to account for this feeling, I might say that it had something to do with the way I was half lying, half sitting on several pillows in the bow, the way the curving walls of the old rowboat framed a foreground for my view as they rose away from me. I saw them, these peeling wooden inner walls, and then my husband's familiar shape. Above him, there was the flat, milky blue sky, and sometimes, when we were close enough to shore, the furred, nearly black line of the spruces and pines against it. In the air above us, swallows darted, dark, quick silhouettes, and once a cedar waxwing moved smoothly through them. Layers of life above me. Below, I could hear the lap of the deep water through the walls of the boat. As a result, let's say, I felt suspended, waiting, between all these worlds and part of none of them. But this isn't really what I believe. I think the sensation came from somewhere within me. We can feel this way sometimes in adolescence, too. Surely most of us can call it up. But then there's the burning impatience for the next thing to take shape, for whatever it is we are about to become and be to announce itself. This was different. There was, I supposed, no next thing. I had felt something like this every now and then in the last year or so, sometimes at work as I tightened a stitch or gave an injection. The awareness of having done this 1,000 times before, of surely having 1,000 times left to do it again, of doing it well and thoroughly and neatly, as I like to do things, and simultaneously of being at a great distance from my own actions. Or at home, setting the table, sitting down with my husband to another meal, beginning our friendly evening conversation about the day, the house quiet around us, the old dogs dozing under the table or occasionally nuzzling our feet. A sense suddenly of being utterly present and also, simultaneously, far, far away. Now I stirred, shifted my weight. My husband turned, no aspect of his face not dear to me. "Hurting?" he asked. And with that, as quickly as it had come over me, the moment ended. I was back, solidly in time, exactly where we were. It was getting chilly. I had been lying in the wooden boat for several hours now, and even though I had the pillows under me, I was stiff. I had a bad hip. Replacement had been discussed, though everyone said I was too young for it. I liked only that part of the problem, being too young for something. "A little," I said. "We'll head back." "Are you sure?" "I've got 2 reasonable ones. I'm a happy man." He began to reel his line in. I turned and stretched. "How nice to be a happy man," I said. He looked over his shoulder at me to get my tone. "It is nice," he said. "And I meant it," I answered. As we rode back, as we drove home, I found myself wanting to tell my husband about my feeling, but then not knowing what to call it. The shadow of it lingered with me, but I didn't say anything to Daniel. He would hear it as a want, a need. He would feel called upon to offer comfort. Daniel is a minister, a preacher, a pastor. His business is the care of his flock. His medium is words, thrilling words, admonishing or consoling words. I knew he could console me, but consolation wasn't what I felt I wanted. And so we drove along in silence, too, and I looked out of the window at the back roads that sometimes seemed utterly rural, part of the 19th century, and sometimes seemed abruptly the worst of contemporary suburban life, the sere, beautiful old fields carved up to accommodate the 2 wide circular asphalt driveways, the 2 grand fake garrison colonial houses. We lived in the center of town, an old, old town, Adams Mills. The Adamses long dead, the Mills long burned down. Our house was a simple square farmhouse, added on to repeatedly at the back of the first floor over the years, as was the custom then with these old New England homes. We had an unpainted barn behind it, and behind that was a small meadow, which turned to pine woods at the far edge, woods that hid our neighbors to the rear, though in the summer we could hear them fighting, calling each other things that used to make the girls laugh with joy. "You fat-ass pig," they'd imitate. "You stupid shithead," which for some years they had uncorrected as shiphead. We used the barn as a garage now, and Daniel had his study out there in a small heated room at the back. When we moved in, it was still full of rusting old tools and implements, the kinds of things people clean up and hang on their walls as folk art. There were still mason jars full of unidentifiable fruits and vegetables in the old root cellar, a dark earthen space you entered by lifting a sort of trapdoor in the kitchen yard. Because of all this, we felt connected to the house's life as part of a farm. Yet, at the front of the house, we were townsfolk connected to the village. Our view was across the old common to the big congregational church. Not Daniel's church, it's true. And we looked at its backside, its rump, the girls had called it. But it was a splendid civic vista nonetheless. Beyond the church, we could see the row of grand Georgian houses lined up face to face with its front. Along one side of the green was an inn, where we could get a fancy and tasteless meal in the main dining room, or a beer and a good hamburger in the bar, with its large screen TV always tuned to the sports network. Along the other side of the green, there were shops, a small, expensive grocery, a video store, a store with high-quality kitsch, stoneware, cute gardening tools, stationery, rubber stamps, coffee table books, Venetian glass paperweights. Everything in town was clapboard, painted white with green or black trim. If you tried another color, the Historical Commission descended on you and made you very, very sorry you had. We turned into our drive now and pulled up next to the horse chestnut that shaded the dooryard. It dropped its leaves early every year. They littered the yard now, and our feet made a crunching noise on them as we crossed to the back door. The nearly bare, ancient branches, twisted blackly above us in the dusky light, made me think of winter. When we opened the door, the house was silent. Daniel began to put his gear away in the spare room off the hall, speaking loudly as he clattered around.
"Boy, it sure is nice to have dogs. Dogs are so great, how they come running to greet you when you get home, how they make you feel like you count even when you don't."
This was a familiar riff, and as I headed to the John, I threw back my contribution.
"Dogs! Dogs! Man's best friend!"
When I came out a few minutes later, all three dogs had finally bestirred themselves from wherever they'd been nesting and were whacking their happy tails around the kitchen. Daniel was cleaning his fish at the sink. The smell already suffused the air, and there was hope of food for them. Nothing excited them more. They barely greeted me. The answering machine was blinking. I turned it on. There were three messages, all for Daniel, which was the way it usually went, except when I was on call. I'm a veterinarian, and the crises among animals are less complex, more manageable than those of humans. Actually, very much a part of my choice of profession. Daniel had turned slightly from the counter to listen to the calls, and I watched his face as he took them in. One about relocating a confirmation class because of a scheduling conflict, one from Morty, his assistant pastor, reporting on the worsening state of a dying parishioner Daniel was very fond of, a young mother with cancer. One from another minister suggesting he and Daniel try to pull something together among their colleagues about some racial incidents in the three closely adjoining towns around us. Daniel's face was thin and sharp and intelligent, his eyes a pale gray-blue, his skin white and taut. I'd always loved looking at him. He registered everything quickly, transparently. With these calls, first annoyance, then the sag of sorrow, then a nod of judicious agreement. But there was something finely self-contained about him, too. I'd often thought this was what made him so good at what he did, that he held on to some part of himself through everything, that he could hear three calls like this and be utterly responsive to each of them, and then turn back and finish cleaning his trout, as he did now.
"Will you go and visit Amy?" I asked.
His plaid shirt pulled and puckered across his shoulder blades with his motion. He was bent in concentration. "I don't know," he said without looking at me. "I'll call Morty back and see when I'm done here." I refilled the dog's bowls with water and poured some more dry food for them. Daniel worked silently at the sink, his thoughts elsewhere. I went out to the front door and got the mail from the box at the road. The air was getting chilly. Darkness was gathering around the house. I turned on the living room lights and sat down.
I sorted through the circulars, the bills. I threw away the junk. While I was working, I heard Daniel leave the kitchen, headed across the yard to his office in the barn to make his calls. With the closing of the door, I felt released from the awareness of his sorrow that had held me in his orbit. I began to roam the house, with the dogs as my entourage, feeling restless, a feeling that seemed connected somehow to that moment in the boat, and maybe also to Daniel's sad news. I went up the steep, narrow stairs to the second floor, where the girls' rooms were. All the doors were shut up there, and I opened them, standing in each doorway in turn. The slope ceiling rooms were deeply shadowed. Light from the hall fell in tall rectangles on the old painted pine floors. In the older girls' rooms, the beds were made. The junk was gone, boxed in the attic or thrown away forever. Only Sadie's room still spoke of her. One wall was completely covered with pictures she'd cut out of magazines. There were stark photos of dances and radical poses, of nearly naked models in perfume or liquor ads, engaged in moments of stylized passion. There were romantic and soft-focused views of places she dreamed of going to, Kuzo, Venice, Zanzibar. There were guys, Daniel Day-Lewis, Denzel Washington, Brad Pitt. In the corner of the room, where the ceiling sloped nearly to the floor, all the stuffed animals and dolls she'd ever owned were standing wide-eyed in rows by height, like some bizarre crowd in the bleachers at a high school event. I went into Cass's blank room and lay down across her bed. Maybe it was the girls I wanted. Maybe I just missed the comfort of their noise, of their smells and music and flesh. And then I laughed out loud, thinking of how angry I'd gotten at them, and how often for these very things. Allie, our old retriever, barked at me for my odd sudden noise. "Sorry," I said, and dangled my hand off the edge of the bed so she could lick it. "Sorry, old girl." Suddenly, I was thinking of a morning years before, when all three girls had climbed into bed with me and Daniel. I kept trying to get up to make breakfast, and this became the game. The twins held me in their bony, hard arms. They wrapped their long, stringy, bare legs around me. They were shrieking, "No! No breakfast! You must stay in the nest! You must!" Sadie, sleepy, plump, all our baby, lay in front of Daniel in the curve of his arm, her pink, wet thumb resting at her lip. The two of them, Daniel and Sadie, were turned to watch us wild wrestlers, but they had moved out to the edge of the bed, trying to avoid the odd knee or elbow. I reached over, making my hand a desperate claw. "Help me, Sadie!" I croaked dramatically from the flailing mound of bony flesh. "Help! Help!" Sadie sobered and looked for a moment up at her father. Was it real? She believed in everything. He made a face that put her at ease. She laughed. She lay thoughtfully still for just a few seconds more before she, too, threw herself forward into the fray, my rescuer. And then Daniel's arms were encircling all of us, and he grabbed somebody from behind, Nora, I think, and swung her up. I felt his legs push powerfully against me. It lasted only a minute or so, the shrieking, the laughter, everyone's nightie hiking up, all the bare flesh, the bones and ankles, feet big and small, soft parts, damp parts, all our familiar smells. Ordinary life, flesh. It was my world then. I was wrapped in it, held in it, I thought. And now I'm not. Now I float. Allie was steadily licking my hand. I turned and she stopped and smiled at me, panting, her long curled tongue flicking upwards slightly with each breath. Laughing Allegra, we had named her, because her face fell into this happy, dopey grin when her mouth opened. "It was fun, wasn't it, Allie?" I said.
She thrust her head forward and licked my face once. I got up and went downstairs into our bedroom. At one time, it had been the front parlor of the house. It had a working fireplace with a painted wooden mantel, but no closet, so it mounted a row of hooks on the wall and hung them with what we most frequently wore. Daniel's slacks and jackets, jeans and scrubs for me, and one or two nighties, both our bathrobes, homely, wrinkled shapes. A motorcycle blatted rudely past on the town road, only a dozen yards or so from our bed. We had talked about moving upstairs to the back of the house now that the girls were gone, but we hadn't done anything about it yet. I stood for a long time in front of the mirror. Flesh, indeed. From time to time, Daniel felt moved to say to me, "God, you're a beautiful woman." But this was kindness or love. I examined myself objectively, clinically now. I saw a nice-looking middle-aged person, someone you wouldn't look at twice if you passed her on the street. And I'd never been beautiful, in fact. I'd been attractive, tall and blonde and strong-looking. I'd had a notable kind of energy, and people, men, were drawn to it. Now, though, when my face was in repose, I looked tired. The down-curving lines at the corner of my mouth made me seem judgmental and stern, even a little pissed off. Sometimes my receptionist, Beattie, a woman I'd known and loved for 20 years, would ask me, out of the blue from my perspective, "What's wrong?" And I'd realize my face had fallen into those lines again. "Nothing," I'd say, and then consciously try to open my face to make it pleasant, to make it, I suppose, younger. Here's what else I knew. I was no longer sure exactly what color my hair would be if I didn't regularly rinse it a color called silver ash. I was about an inch shorter than I'd been in my youth, and had earned at least that much more waistline as my body had compressed. I had arthritis in my hips, and it was starting a little in my back. And I was lucky. I knew this, too. There was no cancer in my family. There were no blood pressure or cholesterol problems. Though my father had died when I was small, it had been an accident of nature, a quick, brutal case of hepatitis. No, I was a good specimen, from good stock. My mother, 80, still worked part-time as a secretary, typing articles and papers for two or three retired professors who'd known her since she was a young woman. She still lived by herself in the house where I'd grown up, though I suppose she was technically not alone, since she'd rented rooms to students at the university, and I suspected that more and more they did the work of keeping the house up. Still, she managed it all. She managed it well. She kept herself going through the long Maine winters. Thinking of her, looking at myself, I wondered if she'd ever felt this sense of dislocation from her past, from her present, from her own reflection in the mirror. This empty unease. And then I smiled at myself, remembering her answer to questions of this nature. "Now, why would I bother to do that?" she'd say. She wouldn't stop what she was doing. She wouldn't turn to look at the 8-year-old or 10-year-old or 13-year-old girl who stood next to her asking. She wouldn't wonder where the question had come from or what its deeper meaning was. She'd slap the sifter to loose the flour. She'd slam the iron down on the shirt under attack. She'd rat-tat-tat even harder on the typewriter and violently fling the return across. "Now, why would I bother to do that?" "Just 'cause, Ma," I said out loud now. And then I turned and said it to the dogs who'd gathered in a circle behind me and were staring up, pondering my immobility. "Just 'cause, guys and gals." Their tails thudded the floor. The little one, Shorty, growled in pleasure just at being spoken to. I felt somehow comforted. This was all of it, no doubt. The strange passing feeling that had come to me in the boat. Age. Vanity. The impossibility of accepting
the new versions of oneself that life kept offering, the impossibility of the old versions vanishing. Ah, well, it had vanished, hadn't it? As surely as the rooms upstairs stood empty and neat in the dark. I washed my face and put on fresh makeup. Daniel came back from the barn, and we began to move around the kitchen making dinner. He hadn't been able to reach Morty, but he talked to everyone else he needed to talk to. Now he turned the radio on to the news. As we did our separate chores, we listened and commented idly to each other on what we heard. The politics, the plane crashes, the crimes, the large disasters of the day, which we all used to keep the smaller, more long-term sorrows at bay. When we were sitting at last at the kitchen table, with a curry I'd quickly put together and a salad he'd made, he looked over at me and frowned. "What's wrong?" he said. Beatty's question. I laughed. "What's so funny?" he asked. "Now, wait a minute," I said. "It's either what's wrong or what's funny. It can't possibly be both." "But it is both. I can't keep up with what goes on in your face. It changes so fast."
"Well, nothing's wrong," I said.
"Ah, but something," he lifted his fork and waved it in rhythm, "is not right." And we smiled at each other in honor of Sadie's favorite book. We began to eat.
"That's about it, I guess," I said after a moment. "The unnameable something."
"Give it a shot," he said. "Name it." I took a breath. And then abruptly I had the sense of how much I loved this conversation, freed of the reports of what one or another of the girls had done in school that day, of what she needed, wanted, had to have before the junior prom, or the class day, or the party at Sarah Malone's. We'd had 5 months of it, alone together, and there were times like this moment, Daniel pushing me, wanting to know me again, that made me feel it would be enough, more than enough, that it would call forth all that was in me. Later, I would remember this moment too, and wish I'd held on to that feeling of possibility.
"I don't know," I said. I shrugged. "Earlier in the boat today, I was feeling odd, just a sense of dislocation, I guess, in my life."
"From what?" And when I didn't answer right away, "Dislocation from what?"
"From just one thing from another, I guess. I don't know."
I looked at him and made a face. It seemed suddenly an embarrassing and even foolish feeling to have indulged. I settled for an easy answer.
"It's probably a little bit about the girls, actually. In a way, missing them, but more, just all that energy, all that work and closeness. Where did it go?"
"It went into making them wonderful, making them who they are." I made a noise and he frowned, which with Daniel was the tensing of a single faint line between his brows.
"Don't go, it's true," he said.
"I'm not consoling you, Joey. I'm not humoring you, so don't act as though I am."
"Ach, I know," I said.
"I know." More gently, he said, "You always go, tch, when I say something good. You should let me be loving to you."
"I know," I said again. "I need to learn to just say thank you."
I reached over and rested my hand on his arm. I could feel the wires under his skin.
"Thank you," I said.
"Thank you," he said. "And you're welcome." After a minute,
"But name it better than that." "Oh, Daniel," I cried.
Still, I stopped and thought for a moment.
"I really don't know. I don't. I've just felt creepy."
Crepuscular? Weird, anyway, all day. It feels admonitory or premonitory or something.
Which? What's the difference exactly?
And he explained, Latin lover that he was, the derivation of each.
But I don't believe in premonitions, he said thoughtfully, after a moment's silence.
I don't either, really. And then I remembered, except, remember the time that Cassanora got up on the roof?
That wasn't really a premonition, though.
I saw them in my mind's eye. I saw them there, with the sky behind them toddling around.
But that was the result of thinking.
You hadn't heard them in a while. Your brain ran through a few options, the kind of stuff they might be up to. You thought of the ladder and the skylight.
I didn't, Daniel. That's not the way it happened. I just saw them in my mind and ran upstairs.
I knew where they were, and I knew I needed to get to them.
Daniel was helping himself to more curry. He looked over at me.
Yeah, but I bet that somehow, maybe so quickly you never remembered it discreetly, you went through those steps.
Yeah, I suppose I might have, but that's not what I remember.
What I remember is popping up through the skylight and seeing them just as I'd seen them mentally, staggering around, happy as larks, as close to death. I held my fingers an inch apart. As that.
I remembered their faces lighting in delight at the sight of me. Just my head sticking up through the open skylight at first, then my hands rising too. They laughed as though I were doing a kind of magic trick, conjuring myself out of thin air.
I stayed right where I was, on the ladder, so they wouldn't be tempted to tease me by running away, a favorite game. So they wouldn't step back over the edge and down. I made my voice as richly cozy and seductive and welcoming and calm as I could through my panic. I spoke as slowly as ooze.
Hi. Hi, you cuties. Come here and tell me what you've been doing. I didn't see you for a long time. Come right here by me. Come by Mama. Come for smoochy sillies. Come right here.
And as they ran forward into my grip,
oh, my good girls, my loves.
But you know, Daniel was saying, the way memory works, you might have attached that image, the real image, the way they truly looked, to your earlier thinking.
Which was premonitory.
Yeah, but maybe not in that exact image-based way.
I stopped and looked at him.
Why are you arguing endlessly with me, Daniel?
I'm not. I don't mean to be.
He looked sheepish suddenly.
I just think it's interesting. I've been doing all this reading about memory, how it actually gets laid down and altered over time. It's fascinating.
Memory,
he sang suddenly in his light tenor,
lights the corners of my mind.
He let the song trail off. I was smiling at him. Plus, of course, he smiled back quickly, I do like to talk. Talking is life, right?
For you, yes.
So, what was this feeling today? Talk to me.
Oh, I don't know. It was silly.
I leaned back.
No, here's what it was. I was looking at myself in the mirror, and I saw myself, and I don't know how I got this way. I made a dramatic gesture down my body. I wanted to amuse him. He had amused me. He looked me up and down.
What way?
Older, not young. Not what I once was.
Ah, but which of us is? He grinned a flash of dry pleasure.
Of course, it's silly. But just from time to time, don't you kind of get swept by it? By the sense of separation between the parts of life? Don't you? Doesn't the part that was crazy and doing drugs and having random sex in the 60s sometimes sit up and wonder what you're doing here? Look at that. I pointed to the counter. There's a Cuisinart there. There's a dishwasher. That's indefensible. He laughed. And then he said, people change, my Joe. That's all you're saying. No, it isn't. I don't think it is. What I'm saying is I don't like this business of whole lives being taken from me. Who's taking anything from you? Whole lives? He made a face. Too melodramatic. It's just life. For a few moments we ate. We talked about the food. I poured myself more wine. Daniel wasn't drinking because he thought he might be going out later. Then, abruptly, he pointed at me with his fork. I mean, Joe, look at my parents, born on farms, raised on farms, both of them farming, raising their kids on a farm. And lo and behold, the kids don't want a farm, so they sell it. They move to town. They grow old, looking out at the parking lot by Meadow Glen Acres. That's disjunctive as hell, but that's the way life goes. See, I don't think it has to. I think it can feel more connected. I bet it used to. I bet this has something to do with goddamn modernity.
Could be, he said.
I sighed. I drank more of my wine.
It's life, Joe, he said after a few moments of silence.
It isn't, I said.
We both laughed small, rueful laughs. Ready to clean up? He asked.
After dinner, Morty called back. Daniel turned his back to me while he talked. His voice was grave, a series of quick, short responses. Okay, okay, yes, okay.
When he hung up, I said, she's dying.
Yes, he said.
I'm so sorry.
I know. He went to change, and I moved more slowly now around the kitchen. The windows had gone black. They were steamy with our life. I was thinking of Amy, his parishioner. I'd met her only a few times. She'd been pregnant the last time I'd seen her, singing in the choir. Her hands, holding the music, had rested on the shelf formed by her big belly in the maroon robe. When he came back, he said, I'm not sure how late I'll be. His face was stricken, frightened-looking. Well, I thought how difficult his job was.
I know, I said.
Don't wait up.
I want to, I said.
He nodded and gripped my arm for a second and left. A while after he'd gone, Sadie called, and her small, light voice made me see her and yearn for her. She was the youngest of my daughters, the easiest, and my love for her was the least complicated. The twins had always been much more difficult. Unplanned, they'd come at the wrong time in our marriage, just when I was starting out as a vet, needing to put in long hours of scut work as the junior partner in a practice. Daniel had their care more than I did, and I sometimes felt shut out from their life together, and from the two of them, too, their mysterious dark twinniness. They cared most about each other. And then suddenly, when they were two or so, they began to fight. Within seconds, they could move from a wild mutual joy to murderous violence. They left the tracks of their tiny fingernails on each other's faces, the beautiful, even red circlet of teeth marks in each other's soft flesh. They pulled out clutches of each other's wispy black hair. They pushed and scratched and grabbed and would not let go, and woe unto him who tried to separate them. We rarely got through a meal without one of them attacking the other, without wails and shrieks and inconsolable sorrow. Intermittently, they'd be best friends again for a while.
Oh, maybe it's over, we'd tell each other. Oh, thank God.
But at the slightest offense, the mildest difference, they'd start again. Why must we live like this? Daniel and I would ask each other. I sometimes wept.
It was so different from what I'd hoped for or imagined when they were born, these two perfect, helpless creatures nested bonelessly side by side. And then, when they were five, along came Sadie, planned for, adored by us all, pliable, sweet. She sat like a small Caucasian Buddha in our midst. I was able to take a maternity leave of 3 months this time, and I lay in bed long mornings, nursing her and sleeping, while the twins were off at kindergarten and then their after-school program. When they came home, they swarmed her. They carried her everywhere with them. She was their doll, their toy, their beloved. She walked and talked late because they were so eager to serve her, to anticipate her every need. They vied for her affection. And Nora, finally, was the winner, the one Sadie began to gravitate toward most often. I think that for Nora, Sadie may have offered a way of escaping from the demands of her bond to Cass, from the wild love, the maddened jealousy. At any rate, she became a kind of second mother to Sadie, and as Sadie got older, she often turned to her before me or Daniel for help and information. Cass was angry. She felt left out. She wanted to go on fighting, and that's what she did, really, with herself, with us, with the world. Dukes up, she charged at everyone and everything. She became the outsider, the tough one, the one we worried about. Even now, here was Nora living in New York with a young man we genuinely liked, going to film school. Sadie had just started college in Western Massachusetts, still loving, still easy, voluntarily in touch all the time. And Cass? Well, Cass played guitar in a band. The last time I'd seen her, her hair was dyed a plummy black that rose around her head in a wildly tased tangle, and she was wearing a lipstick so dark it seemed the color of violence itself. It put you in mind of bruises of dried blood. The band made no money to speak of. Who knows what they ate? A lot of the time they all slept together in their van in parking lots along the highway, on derelict empty streets in faraway cities. Sometimes we didn't know where she was for 2 or 3 months at a time. Then one of us would pick up the phone in the middle of the night, and it would be Cass, collect from a payphone in Louisiana or North Dakota, saying she could only talk for a minute. They were about to go on. There's more snow here than I've seen in my fucking life. I dyed my hair blonde. The van broke down. I broke up with Todd. Now I'm with Raimondo. Oops, they're calling me. Love you. Gotta go. Not Sadie. Sadie called and lazily talked and talked. What's new? She'd ask. What have you guys been doing? Though all she wanted to hear was that everything was the same. Hi, Mom, it's Sadie, is what she said tonight in her little voice. If it isn't Betty Boop, Cass used to tease. Oh, I cried in pleasure. Sadie, Sadie, my shady lady. There was a second of silence. Then she said, God, isn't it bad enough to give me the name? It's a beautiful name. It was Daniel's mother's name. She'd wept when we told her, though she warned us, too, that it was a hard one to live with. Sadie snorted now. What's up? I asked her. I could hear background noises, music, a muted conversation. She had a roommate, she had a boyfriend, she had a whole life only 50 or so miles away. Yeah, well, I had this kind of, like, favor to ask. Okay, I said. I'll try anyway. I've got this professor in my poli-sci class, you know, I told you about her, Jean Bennett. She's just so brilliant. And it turns out she lives in Adam Mills. I mean, she's new, she's just moved there. Hey, I said. So, after I made that connection, I was mentioning you guys to her. Like, if she ever needed religion, she could call Dad. And if she ever needed a vet, she could call you, which I assume was fine. Of course. Though, actually, you know, it was really just like being polite or something.
the way you do, but today after class, she mentioned to me that her dog is having some kind of trouble. She actually told me, but I forget what she said it was. Anyway, she wanted your name, and I gave it to her.
Okay, I said.
Which means, I assume, that she's going to call you, so I wanted you to know.
Okay, I said again.
Mom, she is so amazing. She's just so extraordinary.
Well, I'll try not to embarrass you, dear.
You'll think I'm exaggerating, but it's true, Mom, it's true. You will love her.
And what is her name again, this paragon?
Jean Bennett. Jean. That's one of the cool things. We call her by her first name.
But you've always called everyone by their first name, haven't you? I mean, grown-ups.
Not around here, Mom.
Not professors. Everyone is doctor this or professor that.
I see. Well, I'll look forward to meeting her, I said. Jean Bennett, right?
She made a noise of assent.
And what's new with you, sweetheart, I asked.
Suddenly a deep sigh.
That's my problem, I bet, she said. There's absolutely nothing new.
But every little thing you do is new to us.
Mother!
I mean it, hon. I allowed a beat of silence. And then, of course, I don't. She laughed. And then she sighed again, less dramatically.
Well, if you must know, I'm really stressed. I've got papers. I've got this dance thing.
A recital she was in. Daniel and I were planning to attend. We'd have a fancy dinner at an inn we knew on the way, and then we'd get to see Sadie in motion.
I've got tons of reading I'm so behind on, and I've been having those dreams, you know, where you're taking some tests you're not ready for.
Ugh, I said. She began to tell me how unfair her humanities teacher was not to grant her an extension. As I listened and commiserated, I could hear the dog stirring at some noise in the living room. Sadie's voice, her own sweet voice, combined with all the standardized cadences and phrasings of adolescence, rattled on in her world. The dishwasher sloshed in the kitchen. Daniel's clothes hung touching mine on the rows of hooks. I was alive. I was in all these worlds at once. A finger in every pie, I thought. This is what we grow old for. Sadie asked me our news, and I reported it as blandly as I could.
No need to mention Amy. No point in trying to describe my odd feeling of the afternoon.
It was gone now, anyway.
Finally, she said she had to get off. Oh, but Mom, just when Jean comes, if she comes, don't talk about me, okay?
Never in a million years.
And don't dare tell her how enthralled I am. Swoon, swoon.
Well, now, that would be talking about you, Sade.
Right, Mom.
Her voice had dried. Good night, sweetie.
Night.
When Daniel wasn't back by 11, I took the dogs out for their walk. The air was cool, and I pulled my jacket tight. Light fell from the windows behind me into the yard, and the world disappeared beyond its touch. I stepped forward into it. Often, Daniel and I had done the dog's walk together when the girls were still home, happy just to be alone with each other at the end of the long day, to escape from them and the phone and the duties of the house. We'd stumble through the dark, reviewing our separate days for one another, ignoring the dogs who ran ahead or trailed behind. We'd walk past the stores, the fancy houses, looking in at other people's lives like strolling gods commenting. We'd wander into the unlighted streets off the common that turned gradually into knotted paths, into fields. We'd walk slower and slower as we wound down, bumping into each other more, unmoored and dizzy in the dark. And then, finally, Daniel would say,
"Well, we better head home and see if anyone's still alive."
Reluctantly, yet eagerly now, we'd whistle for the dogs in the soft night air. and turned to start back. That's what I was thinking of that Monday night, before everything changed, before my other life caught up with me. I'd pushed aside that moment in the boat. I was thinking only of Daniel trying to offer comfort in the face of death, of Sadie turning back to her world, and Cass and Nora moving around in theirs. Even of the dogs running after each other through the dark village to sounds and smells I couldn't guess at. And I was remembering that time in our lives together, the time of those ritual walks. I was remembering the way it feels at just that moment when you begin to turn, when you're poised exactly between the things in life you want to do and those you need to do, and it seems, for a few blessed seconds, that they are all going to be the same.
Chapter 2. When I arrived at work the next day, Beatty was already behind the counter, with three dogs moving excitedly around her feet. We let the good-natured boarders loose for company for each other during the day, so there were almost always three or four of them nosing about officiously or sleeping under Beatty's desk. The supervisors, she called them. The barkers, the fighters, we kept in the runs in the back. And the cats had their own room, so they wouldn't be in perpetual panic at the dog's noise. Beatty was on the phone, making reassuring motherly sounds to someone. She would be on the phone fairly steadily through the morning. Tuesday was my day to catch up with all the bad things that had happened to my people's pets while I had my 2 days off. My partner, Mary Ellen, handled the worst of it on Mondays, the real emergencies left over from the weekend. Fights, traumas, difficult births, the sudden onset of skin problems, unexplained loss of appetite, or other gastrointestinal issues. Party time was what Beatty called Monday. Mary Ellen always said she loved it. Even on Tuesdays, though, we tried to hold up to 2 hours empty in the afternoon for the unscheduled visits of clients who'd waited to see me, and we kept the rest of the appointments the equivalent of well baby care, so we could flex around the odd disaster. This was ample random excitement for me. I took my deepest pleasure in the ordinary, in simply re-entering the office with its familiar animal and medicinal smell, in giving what comfort and help I could to the animals and their owners, in just moving around among the polite and curious boarding dogs. I even enjoyed the way Beatty's loud, clucking voice threaded through my day. Now I waved to her and went back down the hall to my exam room to see who my first clients were and what I'd be asked to do for their pets. Animals had come into my life almost by accident when I was 23. I'd just separated from my first husband, and for this and other reasons, I felt that my life was ruined. I didn't believe then in second chances. Broke and full of despair, I retreated from everything and went home to Maine, to my mother's house. There, I wouldn't have to worry about rent or food for a while. But I still needed a job. Any job. Any job but waitressing, I told myself. I was done with that. What I had in mind was some mindless secretarial position. And that's what I got, I thought. I was hired as a receptionist assistant in the veterinarian's office. And so it began, before I recognized it, my second chance. Dr. Moran, my boss, was about 65 then, I suppose. Of course, he seemed ancient to me. He was unsentimental, but gentle and slow-spoken. He called the animals we saw, the cats, the dogs, even the snakes and guinea pigs and gerbils, our friends, or our silent friends. He was fairly silent himself, but I learned to watch the way his hands did his talking for him with the animals. He was small, portly, and neat, and almost completely bald, but he had large, square hands, the hands of a young, strong man. And as they moved over the pets, the animals gentled and stilled. He used his voice too, but only a little. It was his hands that did the trick.
and it was the way he used his hands that I imitated when I began to work with the animals. I worked 7 days a week, including the clean-up and feedings on Sundays, and I was grateful for every minute of it, every minute away from the consciousness of my own failures, away from my misery. Gradually, Dr. Moran trained me to take over more responsibility in the clinic, though the chores were still menial, giving medications, changing dressings, removing sutures, preparing injections. I'd never had pets as a kid. My father, plant lover that he was, didn't believe in it. So I was startled at how easy I felt with the animals, even when at first they were aggressive. I learned to touch them, to move with confidence around them. I was surprised at how much their need and trust affected me. I was surprised when they touched me back. The unexpected flick of a rough, warm tongue. The deliberate, gentle nudge of a wet nose. The first time it happened, I started and then had to swallow several times to keep from crying. I was so oddly moved. Slowly, then, over the first weeks and months of my life in the clinic, I began to believe again in the possibility of a simple kind of goodness, the goodness of the animal's dependency and trust. In response to it, I felt some shift, some opening up in what I'd thought of as my hardened self. I remember the first time I woke in the morning and was aware of anticipation, of eagerly looking forward to getting up, going to work, just to take care of, to be touching again, a young hunting dog I'd nursed through a chest injury. He'd been ripped open by a barbed wire fence he'd tried to jump. A few months after I'd started the job, I signed up at the university for the first of the science courses I'd need for vet school, and a year and a half later, I was enrolled and beginning my training. Even now, at this point in my life, when much of what I did at work was routine, when very little could happen to the primarily dogs and cats I had in my suburban practice that I hadn't seen and dealt with dozens of times before, even now I enjoyed it. Enjoyed the falling away of other concerns when I came into the office. Enjoyed the differences among our silent friends. I took delight in the humor in much of what went on, and felt grieved, but enlarged, too, by what was sad or painful in the powerful bonds between animals and humans. That Tuesday morning, I had some puppy shots, a suture removal, 2 rabies vaccines, a dog who needed his anal sacs emptied, a cat catheterization, and an abscess to clean on a cat named Henry, who was entirely too familiar to me. I tried for the 6th or 7th time to persuade his owner that he should be neutered.
Neutralized,
she insisted on calling it, as though it were some science fiction fate I'd inflict on him with a ray gun. She was young, what we might have called a hippie 30 years ago. The flannel shirt rather than the pierced nostril kind. She always turned me down about Henry.
I like him to know he's a boy, she said to me coyly today.
Louise, he has absolutely no doubt that he's a boy, I said. He's tormented by being a boy. How many times have I treated him for abscesses? Do you think he enjoys that? Do you think he enjoys the fights? It's not dating when you're a cat, Louise. She stroked his scarred orange head. He'd lost a good chunk of ear long ago. He looked tired today, tired and dusty.
We don't know what it's like for him, she said.
I think it's fair to say that this stuff hurts. I would venture that.
But you can't say he'd choose not to do it.
It's your choice, Louise, not his.
Well, I like him just the way he is.
She put her face down next to his head. He squinted, his eyes shut in pleasure. His tail whipped once on the table. I heaved a sigh. Well, I have to accede to that. But I also have to say I don't like to. It's against medical advice, and it's contrary to common sense, and it's not too responsible either. I pointed at her. All those kittens and no child support. She laughed gaily and carried Henry out. Over lunch, Beattie talked about her older sister, who had lived with her since her retirement, and who was addicted to the shopping network. Made her mad, Beattie said.
It should be like gambling, she announced. You should have to go someplace special to do it, like Atlantic City, so you'd notice it more, what you were up to, she said.
Her sister often didn't even bother to open the cartons and packages when they came now. They were stacked in the hall or behind the couch her sister pulled out to sleep on. When she said this, Beattie gestured over her shoulder, where, as it happened, the dog's runs were. We were sitting at a picnic table out back in the weak sunlight, wearing sweaters against the fall chill, and listening to the intermittent barking. Our office was in one of the tiny malls that had sprung up everywhere around these old towns as quickly as mushroom patches after rain. It was next to a bagel shop and a dry cleaner, and the land behind us rolled slowly down to a brook whose name I loved. Brother Brook. When the dogs were quiet, you could hear its steady rush.
Isn't there something like TV Shoppers Anonymous, I asked, some group cure?
She made a snorting sound.
Should be, if there isn't, she said.
She took a tiny bite from a sandwich and chewed daintily.
And how's your family? She asked after a moment,
as though it were all part of the same enterprise from her perspective.
Beattie was white-haired, small, with a bird-like quick delicacy. She'd known the girls since they were babies.
Good, I said. We never hear from Cass, but Nora and Sadie are well, thriving, I'd say.
And how's my boy? She asked, grinning.
The wind puffed her thin hair strangely around her ears, and I looked away.
Daniel? He's fine. He caught 2 trout yesterday, and he said he was happy.
Happy,
she said in a faraway voice, as though it were an emotion she could only vaguely recollect.
Lovely.
The afternoon jammed up and was crazy, as often happened. I had a cat who'd been hit by a car and needed a bone set. A dog who'd gotten into a fight with some kind of wild animal. A boa constrictor who seemed depressed, according to his worried teenage owner. He had, I thought, a cold. It wasn't until after 4 that Beattie tossed a folder labeled Jean Bennett onto the steel examining table, and I remembered Sadie's call from the night before. I glanced through the information quickly. The dog's name was Arthur, a mutt. He was 9. He'd been experiencing trouble walking for a while, most acutely for the last couple of days. I stepped into the hallway and called the woman's last name.
Bennett?
To my surprise, as she appeared around the corner, I'd assumed glamorous youth, Jean Bennett was close to my age. I would have said 46 or 47 to my 52. A different type, though. Exotic. Long, frizzing grey hair was set free around her head and shoulders. I watched her approach down the hallway. She was carrying the dog, who was medium-sized, mostly Cocker Spaniel, I thought. Jean Bennett wore dangly earrings and several loops of beaded necklace. Black leather pants with a long knitted tunic top over them. Expensive leather boots.
Hello,
she said as she moved toward me. I said hi and stood back to let her enter the room. She moved awkwardly past me to the table where she set the whimpering dog. He lay down immediately.
I'm Jean Bennett,
she said, turning. She made a quick pass at smoothing her hair down.
Well, I'm awfully glad to meet you, I said. I'm Dr. Becker, the famous Sadie's mom.
We shook hands. Her bracelets clashed metallically. She had smooth olive skin, dark brows. I'm strictly forbidden on pain of death to talk about Sadie with you. I drew my finger across my throat and she smiled. So, let's move right in on our friend Arthur here. Tell me what's going on with him. I moved to my side of the table and put my hand on his back. He was trembling with fear, long shudders every few seconds. He was short-haired, mostly a marmalade color, with a cocker's sweet, reproachful eyes. His ears were flat to his head.
Well, Arthur,
She shrugged in exaggerated helplessness.
What can I tell you? His story is, all of a sudden, he seems not to be able to walk, but just in his hindquarters. He's mostly just been dragging himself around by his front legs.
For how long?
Well, he's been like this for a couple of days now. Actually, he's had arthritis for a couple of years. He's on medication for that, and it's been lots worse this fall, worse than ever. So that's what I was thinking this was. And all fall, really, it would get worse for a few days, and then it would get better. And honestly, my life is so crazy right now that I just kind of ignored it, I guess, thinking the same thing would happen. And now it's somehow over the edge. I feel terribly guilty. Mea culpa.
She patted her chest. Has he lost bladder control? Bowels?
Now her hand rose to her throat. Well, it's hard to know exactly, since he can't get himself to the door anymore.
So he has accidents?
Oh, yes. Plenty of those.
She sounded grimly amused.
And was there any trauma that you know of? Did he have a fall or get struck by a car or something like that? Even a glancing blow?
No, nothing. Nothing that I know of.
Arthur has what you might call a quiet life. He's inside by himself all day, and I probably don't walk him enough at night either. He just got up Friday and, well, he couldn't get up on Friday, actually. But I thought maybe it was just one of these temporary crises, something that would get better by itself, so